the moment, though, I'd like to introduce two very special people. The first of them, my ex-colleague and co-curator here, Helen Jones, who has now disappeared off to Edinburgh, and I'll let her explain her, her new ventures to you. But we miss Helen very much, and it's lovely to have her back here with us today. And Helen is the curator of this exhibition, and so she'll talk a little bit more about that. And Graham Chalton, who is a painter who I've been a fan of for years and years and years. I'm also absolutely delighted that we've finally got your paintings here in the gallery for this exhibition, but also I'm delighted to say that we will be purchasing this piece for the collection. So visitors to Walsall for years and years to come will be able to enjoy that piece of work. So without further ado, I shall grab myself a stool and I shall hand over to Helen and Graham.
Okay, thanks. Our plan was that we were, you know, over the next 45 minutes that Graham and I would be in conversation and talk about his work in relation to the show. And we're very keen that you join that conversation with us as well and ask questions throughout as well as at the end as well. And we'll be here a little bit after if you've got further questions. But I just wanted to start by talking about the show. It was a complete kind of dream show to curate and very much curated in the way that I believe in, that it happened very organically and very naturally and was a response not only to the way in which I felt artists were currently making work at this moment, but the kind of personal way that I was kind of mapping out spaces and thinking about this idea of what constitutes a place and whether those places are kind of how they exist in our memories, but also their kind of physical locations and where they are. And this show seems particularly more pertinent now that I've moved to Edinburgh and I've just started my master's degree there. And I have this new city that I'm navigating. And yes, there are main roads and there's key buildings and there's a beautiful castle and there's this and this and this and that. But there are little small details. There's the corner shop where all the paint's chipped off the corner, and I wonder why haven't they painted it? It looks so tatty. Or there's the particular shopping trolley that sits on the bridge on the way to the canal, and then there's this and then there's this, and there's all these new kind of landmarks that have created my new kind of map of this city. And coming back to Walsall and getting the train over from Birmingham, which was the route that I used to do every day when I worked here, I realised that the show before us of these quite ordinary places exists on that train journey. When you look out of the window, there seems to be this kind of boundary, I feel, that you cross from Birmingham into Walsall or into the Black Country. Maybe it's the kind of Bescot motorway, but out of the train window, all of these kind of views that you see in that show are there. And I just wanted to read out a passage from a short story that featured in George Shaw's catalogue, which accompanied his show at Baltic, which I went to see when I started planning the show, and it really made me think about how I was going to pull all of these ideas together. And it's about a guy reminiscing about his childhood holidays, and actually the train journey is the thing that he remembers more than the actual holiday himself. So I think, you know, sometimes other people say things so clearly, so I'll repeat this chap rather than trying to re-articulate it. It's from a story called The Book of Imaginary Worlds by Peter Hobbs. And it's on this journey, and about it he says, "I suppose it was the first time I'd understood that the world has other centres than one's own. It's not a profound discovery exactly, but then I have known people who seem never to have made it. As the train picked up speed, the gardens came and passed more rapidly, slipping into view and sliding out of sight, being replaced by more hedges and more houses, separated suddenly by an arrow and then closed alongside us, aching for exploration. Then came a cluster of green woodland where well-worn tracks ran among the shadows, and then houses again, a row of derelict garages at their end, a glimpse of a gap in a fence, a path running deep into the undergrowth. It became clear to me that there must be too many of these places to count or know, that there must be infinite paths, infinite yards, and that each of them was owned by some child or stranger, and that though those places were only promises to me, they were full of fulfilled meaning to them, the heart of myriad childhood games and imaginings, the centre of all their stories. So this journey that I had on this train, it isn't just about me and my observations and my thoughts, but there are plenty of other people kind of thinking similar ways or have their own kind of particular reference points, which brings me on to Graham and all of the other artists in the show. And I just wanted to kind of, first of all, ask you, Graham, about the reference points that appear in your paintings as well, and this idea of what constitutes a place for you as well.
My reference points are quite varied in a way. Probably from all the people in this show, some of the other people are very embedded in a particular place, like George Shaw with his place where he grew up in Coventry and so on. My reference points are much more wide than that in a way, in that they are, so if we look at this piece here, which I'm standing in front of, the reference points for this are from a lot of different places. Some of them, hardly any of them, maybe two or three of them are from my own observations, my own photographs. But the rest are from a wide variety of sources, postcards, architecture books, books on town planning, newspaper photographs, all kind of odd bits and pieces. But given that range of sources is quite wide, they all look kind of similar. They all look a bit like a certain place. And they're all chosen so that they're not particularly recognisable. So, you wouldn't know. I don't think there's anything particularly famous there. There are maybe one or two. You wouldn't know that that was a university building in Caracas, for instance, which is what it is. But it looks like something down the road from us. And to a certain extent, particularly, and these are all sort of 20th century places, to a certain extent you could say that 20th century places look a bit the same. There's a certain generic design which is throughout. So wherever you go, you may well be reminded of somewhere else, or sometimes surprised when you see something and it looks like something you know, but it's not quite right. It's a bit different. There's a small undefined difference to it. I remember going abroad years ago. Maybe it was the first time I ever went abroad, and there was a branch of CNA on some street in Paris or something. For those younger people, CNA was an old department store. I think, are they Dutch or something, aren't they, I think? And I only thought CNA was in Leicester, but there was one in Paris or somewhere. And it's just an ordinary CNA store. And it's startling and surprising. And it takes you by surprise, and you suddenly are very aware of what you know and what you don't know, and what you're embedded in and what you're not. And everything gets a little bit unstable and quite interesting then. So in answer to your question, yeah, the sources for these are various, but quite particular as well. So all these places become sort of one space, one place, which is that place which is in my head.
And what particularly unites them, particularly in a sequence like this, is the composition. Yes. And that's something that you've made these decisions. So you found these images, postcards, flip through a magazine, but you've made a particular edit there. And created these compositions. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that as well.
Yeah. Well, it was kind of conceived as a series. It was originally, I think, six, and then it grew. So compositionally, there's basically one building on each panel, on each canvas. Occasionally with a suggestion of the context of the building, but not really So the building is isolated from its context. You can't tell, you can't see the rest of the place around it. So we don't know that that's actually in a shopping mall in Sweden or that's a hotel in Benidorm. It's just a building. So compositionally, they're placed reasonably centrally on a fairly flat ground of colour, sometimes inflected, and very much made of paint. So if you work in the medium of painting, it's quite difficult sometimes because there's just so much of it. People have been painting for thousands of years and it's just there's a lot of painting out there. So you cannot help but have some sort of relationship or dialogue with other painting, with the history of painting and the painting you like and so on. And some of the paintings I like are abstract paintings, so there's a certain sort of consideration of composition which is pure composition, what will harmonise visually. But to tie it all together, there is this isolation going on. And then also on the ground colours are chosen sometimes, well, mostly to have a slight sort of a time code in them. So some of the, I look at a lot of photography and popular stuff, you know, Homes and Gardens magazines or whatever. And if you look at a Homes and Gardens magazines from 1963, the colour printing in it is a very particular kind. And nowadays, printing is almost too good. It's like very good. But in 1963, the prints, there were certain yellow ochres and blues and things which cropped up. And it would be the same in movies as well. You know, if you look at a movie, a Hollywood movie from that era, and it's filmed in, you know, Todeo or something like that, people have blue hair and strangely coloured. The whole thing is completely, it's the real world, but it's nothing like the real world. And that difference is very interesting between reality and depiction, reality and fiction and whatever. So again, in my mind, probably not at all in yours, you know, that that yellow-green composition combination is quite time-coded, and some of these other colours are as well. Yeah.
Another interesting source for you is postcards as well, and we've got a collection, kind of a small snippet of Graham's vast collection of postcards down on the mezzanine level. And some of Graham's sketchbooks as well, where you can see the certain kind of elements or building which have been taken out of these postcards. But what I really liked about that is almost this kind of time essence as well, and that when you send a postcard, you're choosing one particular vision of a place or a snapshot and sending that to someone, so they get this kind of remote in view of this place that you've been to. So it's this kind of entering someone into your world, but creating this, selecting the kind of snapshot that they would see as well.
Yeah, it is. It's fascinating. I love the idea that people used to, still do, but not very much, send images to each other, which is great, isn't it? You know, I mean, I'm fascinated by images and the way we are, as personalities, probably the sum total of all the images that we've seen. We are quite visual people, probably, whether we know it or not. So those images are incredibly important. And the idea of just sending each other images is great, instead of just an email. I suppose people now might do it as email attachments, and they do it on Facebook, and there's still an exchange of images. But it used to be places, and the idea that you've gone somewhere else would be quite unusual, probably. Again, we probably move around a lot more now. But the idea of somewhere else and then sending somebody a picture of it. I'm at this very unusual and wonderful place, and it looks a bit like this, except that it doesn't. And that a lot of the postcards might have been, particularly older ones, very altered. So they might be black and white photographs, and then somebody's inked with a brush, blobs of colour all over the top. And then that is reproduced as the postcard. So what you're looking at is a sort of painting. It's a painting which mixes paint with photograph. which is quite a modern idea in a way, but you know, it exists in these old cards. And again, that place then is sort of nothing like what it is. It doesn't really look like the prom at Blackpool. It's this vision of it, which is totally unreal, but is maybe more than real, is intensified somehow, which is what art does as well, isn't it? So they're great, they're great sources for me. They do a lot of things that painting does, I think, already, and they're good to as a source material.
And maybe this language of painting that you mentioned brings us on to actually how you paint and how you make that transition of this image to the actual painting itself. And you've talked a lot about creating this moment when an image or a place comes into being, which I think is really important and crucial. But also there's a shift in scale within all of these things as well. And I just wanted to just set the scene of Graham's studio, that all of these images are all around him. So all on the desk, all in the sketchbook. It looks so kind of neat and refined here, but there is
not the word that springs
a whole
to mind.
Kind of an abundance of material that you're constantly kind of working in. But it'd be great to hear more about the kind of process that you go through to get that moment where these places suddenly come into view.
Yeah, I do. Yes, again, it's probably down to the relationship between the paint and the image. So, I do surround myself with lots of imagery, maybe too much, sometimes it's confusing. But I often start, again, referring to these or basically any of my paintings in this show, probably started off as quite an elaborate painted ground on which I wasn't, no real idea what was going to go on top. And then these are mainly acrylic paintings, but sometimes with some oil on top to tease certain things out. So with lots of thin transparent layers of acrylic glazes or stains, you can build up these very rich, coloured, quite resonant surfaces. Which are almost little paintings in their own right, but I'm not courageous enough to stop at that point. I have to put something on them. I could never really work non-figuratively. And then it's a question of what might be appropriate to go onto the surface. So then, whenever I choose an image, it then goes on and the surface might change again. So there's a relationship. So the image isn't just sort of on top of the surface, it's also part of the surface that's underneath. So there's a sort of spatial play between flatness and three dimensions, which again is an essential part of a painter's means. And then sort of teasing out of this already maybe quite elaborate surface some sort of image. And it is kind of... with some of these, and more maybe with one or two in the other room, and that, I don't know if you can see that one just behind Helen, the dark one of the trees there. That moment when the paint, and often these are painted flat on the floor because the paint is very wet, so they're literally puddles, which is kind of a mad thing to do, isn't it? Technologically, when you think how you might be able to make images with CGI and something, and you're on the floor manipulating puddles. But anyway, at some point this puddle becomes an image and it's absolutely startling, and it's there, and it's maybe never going to go away. Fantastic. And that point of becoming is a really wonderful thing, and is maybe also a metaphor for it's very kind of them. It's almost metaphoric for the way you might think, or the way, you know, occasionally you have moments of realization or ideas come to you, or you suddenly maybe something becomes clear, or it might go the other way, it becomes less clear and you don't know what it is. But those moments when things shift and move, and that teasing out of the image is fascinating. And that one there is sort of, there's another version of that, which the first version of that is hardly there. It's just a black ground and a couple of green stains.
Is this America?
Yes, yeah. A few years ago, my pal Mike moved to America to work in a sort of museum there. And I went to visit him 3 or 4 years ago. And that's a gap between the edge of his house and a tree next door. And it's a gap which goes down this lawn into a sort of copse at the bottom, and there's a lake beyond that. So it's one of those places where it's sort of, you can't see it, but there's a possibility that there's more beyond. I don't know if you ever, whenever you go to the seaside, in fact, not necessarily the seaside, it could be anywhere. Sometimes you look down a street or a road and it's empty at the bottom of the road, and you feel that the sea is beyond it. Have you? I don't know if you ever, maybe just me. But it's something to do with open space or light or something, but you feel there's something beyond that. So that's sort of going on in that. But the way, say, the black ground is at once near to us, the side of a house, and then it's far away as the shadows in those trees, but it's actually exactly the same black ground with nothing going on, nothing's changed. It's just become spatially moved. Again, is one of those just fabulous things that painting does, which nothing else can do. So it's very important that paintings do that, I guess. Yeah.
And your titles are very, very simple. And for instance, pub or a gap or apartment. I mean, how important to you is it that we know exactly where those places are?
It's not really important at all. It will probably take away, because otherwise, it'd probably take away from it. Because if it was too specific, you, the viewers, can make them your own places. But if you knew exactly where they were, it takes a little bit of something away, probably. So I wouldn't want to say where they were particularly. Although, having said that, this particular one was made as part of a series about a particular place. So if you saw that original show, you would be able to locate that. But it is, whatever it is, a Victorian or slightly pre-Victorian, maybe Georgian pub, which you might find in any town in England, really. But made to look like nothing on earth, probably. Titling is quite difficult. It's you either end up with something highly pretentious and convoluted. You know, like a Damien Hirst or something, or you just name it. And I like that. I like the prosaicness, the ordinariness of that very simple title. It's a sort of it's something quite definite to hang on to, in what will probably become an increasingly less definite image the more you look at it. So it is a little peg somehow.
The point that you mentioned earlier about that despite technology, painting can do something that no other medium can do is very important, particularly for this show. And we have a number of artists who are producing these painstakingly detailed images of these nondescript places that we could photograph. You know, we could kind of capture those images very easily, but there's something about kind of revisiting these places or kind of using a very kind of labour-intensive medium to try and capture the essence of a particular place. And what I always kind of particularly like when working on a group show is the relationships that you get, not only that I construct between the artists, but also to kind of get that response from artists themselves. And Graham and I spent quite a lot of time talking whilst we were planning the exhibition. I came to the studio 3 or 4 times or something. And actually the way that the show was developing was a really important aspect of our discussions, as well as talking about Graham's work. So we wanted to talk about Graham's work in response to some of the artists in the show and perhaps move round a little bit. But maybe we should first talk about Christiane Baumgartner and these images that kind of in a particular, that just kind of come together quite magically, and she painstakingly cuts out these images with woodcuts. She does it all on her own, with no assistance, lying them on the floor. But she works first and foremost with film and quite often CCTV footage, or this kind of quite abundance of technology that's around, that she then kind of reduces it back to a very kind of simplistic medium and quite a traditional medium. And I just wondered if you wanted to kind of add a little bit to that, or talk about your work in response to her.
Yeah.
Should we move across? Should we move round? What I quite liked about them was this kind of fleeting. They were the more kind of fleeting moments, that they were kind of neither kind of here or there in a road tunnel or on a motorway as well. And it's those snippets that you pick up whilst in motion.
Yeah. these are lovely prints, I think. I don't know about Laura, but just not much in this show that's not derived from photographs or moving images.
They're
pretty well, yeah.
Have some source material in,
yeah,
in a photograph or kind of a printed matter.
Yeah. But these prints of Christiana Baumgartner's are derived from moving image rather than still image, particularly videos. She must just like drive and somebody's making a video, or vice versa. So there is that sense, and again, like pretty well everything in here, there's that sense that there's the places that she's looking at or she's depicting are quite ordinary. They're very everyday things. You might have been along a road like this to get here today. They're just everywhere, in every country, wherever. And that sense of how you might experience, particularly, well, not just how you experience the world, urban places, landscapes, now, is often by moving through it. You're on a train, you're in a car, whatever. We don't get out and walk around so much anymore, probably. So there is this sense of passing through and of movement going on in there, which again, I think with the other bits in the show which are in series, like mine or the Laura's set over there, Paul's set in the other room, there's an implied kind of movement through there, like we're almost moving through some sort of urban space by purely by dint of the fact there's an image after another image after another image, which is exactly what you experience when you move. But these somehow are moving more so. They feel like we are, because we are literally on a road, and there's lines in a very traditional compositional way, like an impressionist painting, leading us into the distance, from the foreground into the distance. So she uses perspective views a lot. Not always, sometimes they're flat on from the side of the car, but often they're from the front looking down into space. So the implication is of movement is much more, and the transitory nature of them is therefore much more. So then when she gets a still from the video, and then painstakingly using this fantastic old printmaking technique of woodcut, which, you know, not long ago people would have been amazed that, in contemporary art you would use something like a woodcut. It seemed like surely that's now would never be a contemporary medium. But the mere fact that it goes from video to something so traditional, labor-intensive, something that takes a long time to make, there's a great sort of marriage between the two, the fleeting image and the time it takes to make the image, which makes the image much more solid and still and somehow more important and significant. So the medium again is using, it's the properties of the medium are very much part of the meaning of the image that we see. They create the meaning.
And this idea of journey and repetition is actually not only kind of carried out in sequence or the kind of repeated images in the show that we see with Christiane or Paul Winstanley. But Laura Oldfield Ford and George Shaw actually kind of take us on these journeys, and they've both taken repeated walks in. Laura came to Walsall and she made a number of walks over a period of months, and George had took 12 walks around the Tiled Hill estate in Coventry, where he grew up as well. And there's this actual kind of, there's something about this repetition, both within the kind of physical making, but both within a kind of journey, and this repeated journey. And with George and Laura, it's about kind of particular places and finding these echoes wherever they may be. So Laura's has made these walks in Walsall, in Bristol, in London. She's about to go to China as well. And we were just talking before about how it's very much within all of these locations, it's about the kind of connections that translate one place onto another. And it's particularly interesting, this the kind of post-war kind of design, you see utopian design that she's looking at, or way in which kind of design of cities and town has become ubiquitous from place to place, so it becomes a little bit more generic, and trying to kind of, but through that she wants to kind of pick out the nuances as well that create those places unique. But there's something about the way that she's made an edit of those. She's also worked from photographs, but like we were talking before about the compositions that you've made, that Laura, whose work is behind you on this wall here, maybe we should turn and look, that she's made this kind of edit. The drawings are painstakingly made with biro and very illustrative, but there are these washes of colour which kind of add these, almost a sense of, I don't know, kind of emotion to it or something.
Yeah. Yeah, they're interesting. They're, if you look at the sort of history of art, history of cultural production of the last 50 years, there is a sort of strand which is to do with cities, I suppose, which is about sort of how you move through cities, how you experience them, what's your place within them in the midst of all that complexity. Goes back to the situationists in the 50s who would basically go for a walk. They would go and get lost in a city and experience it in a different way than they would if they were on a very particular mission. And there are lots of artists who kind of just walk, and they document their walks. They make us think about where they've walked and so on. And there is a thing around now called psychogeography, which is quite a big thing, and lots of people are interested in it. And that's sort of about the way places might contain or embody feelings, history, experience, thought, the way the place itself might literally contain that. Some of these psychogeographers are semi-mystic, very strange people. It's a very interesting area. And the more elaborate cities have gotten, the more complicated and difficult it is to find your own place within them, the more interesting this gets. And I think that's what Laura does, isn't she? She uses this strategy of going for a walk. She takes herself through maybe the East End of London or wherever it is. I think she probably is interested in certain areas, maybe in transition areas which have been knocked down and then something else has been built, and then that's about to be knocked down and something else is about to be built, and they're a little bit ruined, or something's about to happen. And this sort of vibration within those sort of places, I think, is probably what she's getting at in some way. Yeah.
Yeah, she very much kind of follows these kind of feelings or this kind of essence when she sets out on a walk. There's no particular end point that she has to get to. It's about kind of responding to what she sees, or trying to kind of gather a sense of maybe what's kind of happened there in the past, and following those. It's a kind of emotional mapping rather than a more traditional mapping exercise. But Laura's also talked about them as history documents as well. And it was interesting what you were saying, Graham, about the works being or looking at places that are at a point of change, or there's a kind of flux within a lot of the works. And even the drawings that Laura's made in Walsall, which she made over last summer, places have kind of changed since she made those drawings. So shops that she's made illustrations of, they've closed. The hotel that you could see being built from the gallery's window on the canal, that kind of suddenly shot up very quickly. And the two larger drawings depict the motorway under the M6 motorway at Bescot. And she took the photographs, decided on her composition and started working on them. And at that moment, the diggers moved in. And it's now kind of, I'm not sure if anybody knows what the plans are for that particular area, but it's almost, it has already become a history document because she's captured it at that particular time, which, you know, it doesn't exist anymore. That place isn't there, but it exists within this drawing and then our kind of memories and knowing of that place as well. So it really kind of reinforced this idea that although a lot of this work is about kind of physical, solid structures, that there also is this kind of undercurrent of change, and that everything's quite vulnerable at the same time as well. And another point that Graham and I have discussed is that there's no people in these paintings. I think there's one guy, there's a horse, and there's a guy on a BMX in one of the works as well. But apart from that, there are no depictions of people, but yet they seem very much charged with human presence as well. And maybe we should look at that with George and Barry, maybe. Shall we move through? And it's very interesting to talk about George Shaw's paintings, which are all based in Coventry with Graham, because Coventry is where Graham works. So this environment is kind of very familiar to you as well.
Yeah. None of these images do have people in, apart from the boy on the BMX or whatever. But they're full of people. So in a way, the places are people. You could say the places and their often instability. They're there and then they're not there. They're there, then they're pulled down, just like people. They're both presence and absence. And that could be a metaphor, a very strong metaphor in different ways. In fact, I think that one is the site of a pub where George Shaw's mum used to work, which was then demolished. So all you see is a rough idea of where the floors were. So that then becomes this sort of metaphor of a whole life lived in a particular place and then removed or moved on or whatever. The people in the people, I say these are full of people, but the people are probably us. So we are the people in the images. We kind of complete them in some way. And they are, I guess, both Barry and George use this. Paul as well. The relationship between the photograph and the painting is closer. They are a bit photographic, aren't they? They're not quite photoreal pieces, but they're heading that way. I've no idea how he manages to keep using this horrible paint. He's obviously a very patient man, and he can now use it in various ways.
He can use it much more subtly. If you look at the previous work, it was much more thick, the paint. The paint itself is a metaphor for him, so it's very important that he uses that paint. And this, again, there's this very sort of formal front-on composition. And again, there's often roads and streets as they were passing through. And Barry's, which are much more, I was going to say less specific, but probably highly specific, aren't they, in that it is a path which is across the field. It is a little group of trees which have, which are real places, have their own history and significance for him. So this particular place is the hinterland that exists around Barry's childhood home in Essex. So this is where Barry would go when he was young with his dad and go bird watching, or he would kind of bunk off school there kind of later on, or kind of hang out with his mates, or write music, or probably, you know, smoke a cigarette or something. You know, it was kind of his kind of escape, this place. But for me, they feel kind of very romantic. It's kind of almost looking back at them with kind of rose-tinted glasses or something. But all made with pencil, they're not photographs, he does work from photographs. But the way in which they're made, and also with George's use of umbral paint, there's something about this kind of adolescent hobby or something with both of the way that they kind of make this work, but also this kind of thought that, and then double that with this fascination of this place where they grew up.
Yeah, they both seem to have this connection to their childhoods, which is because of the intensity of the relationship there with the place that they were as children, which again, everybody probably knows. I suppose I do, but I don't choose to paint the streets where I grew up, but maybe there's an echo of those streets somewhere where I do, but I don't know. But these guys are both really, really, really embedded in their own places. It seems complete with it, particularly with George, and he won't leave this. This is sufficient imagery for him to just see the need to keep going forever. And he can encode all kinds of connections into these places just by wandering around fairly small areas, but Coventry is a state. So it's quite an extraordinary thing. And also, it's very English in a way, isn't it? It's very, I know he's a big fan of writers like Philip Larkin and so on, that English attention to detail, or a kind of worrying away at experience that you've had, which, you know, you can't let go, and it's all a bit. This is very English, isn't it? I'm sure French people aren't like that, or Americans, but it's a very English thing that we do. Don't know why. Something to do with a complex structure of our society or something. But it's become very important, and you can't get rid of it somehow. And maybe it's why you should.
But whilst George and Barry, their work is very much embedded in this place, it doesn't mean that we're necessarily excluded from that. Either, does it? And I think that's what is the thing that makes them interesting, I think, in the light of this show. And I'm not sure if anybody saw George Shaw's exhibition in Coventry. And what was fascinating was overhearing the conversations of people who lived on these streets talking about them. I'm thinking that, you know, you're never going to really get that anywhere else, and I just wanted to really kind of listen in and kind of really take note of all those stories, because they do something completely different when they're not shown in that town. And we've had a similar experience with the drawings that Laura's made from Warsaw.
Yeah. But this function is, these are kind of full-blown romantic imagery. This is, they're paintings rather, they're not descriptive. Well, they're not only descriptive, they do describe something. But the lowering skies, the greys, that show Coventry was full of, you know, beams of sunlight, darkness, briefly done. But very much, you know, romanticised or romantic images, the big moment, it's not completely black and white. And the way that light carries feeling is again, probably quite a common thing going through here. But they're full-on romantic visions, aren't they, in a way? It may be more powerful by the ordinariness of the sort of seemingly ordinariness of their subject matter. Or the subject matter is a romanticism, not that pitch, probably. I know George Shelfrey is just curator the show of the old English 20th century neo-romantic artist Graham Sutherland in Oxford. He's very into all that sort of thing, isn't he? So they're not at all descriptive, they're doing something much, much different, aren't they, I think. Yeah. There's one artist we're still to look at in the show, if people have still got time. I'm just conscious that we've said we've talked for 45 minutes and we've just gone over that. But maybe looking at Colvin Stanley's would be a really good conclusion, because he brings all of these things together, the light, the romanticism, but also brings us back to the phrase that you mentioned before about looking beyond something, or this notion of like looking out to sea. And I'm not sure if you've seen Paul Stanley's paintings in the exhibition yet, but they're all based on this veiled curtain in front of this window. Yeah, if we go and have a look. And for me, it's always about this kind of prospect of what lies beyond this. And it's almost as if it's a, trying to think of the word, a kind of threshold into another place. But also he leaves the paintings quite open to interpretation as well, that we kind of work out what we can see and piece that together. And whilst we've been talking about very specific places, this is actually kind of, theoretically this place doesn't exist. It's a room that's in Bloomsbury in London, and the trees are taken from a completely different source, taken whilst he was on holiday in Scandinavia. So it actually, you know, this, yeah, it's not a real place, but yet that kind of, that doesn't matter in this context. And if you look, it's interesting with Paul's relationship to the photograph, because he takes a lot of photographs. And the photographs themselves are very beautifully composed, very formal photographs, filled with a certain kind of light. Very sort of modernist painter's eye going on there, probably. But with this very resonant light going on in them. So far, in a way, he could just exhibit the photographs, but by moving them through into this other medium, the imagery then becomes something else. And as Helen says, what we're looking at is not necessarily real, so it may be two views put together, an interior and exterior, which are then blend together, and made into this other image, which again has this sort of romanticism in it, which he's actually directly referenced in some of his work. There's an interior painting of his, which I recall, which has a painting on the wall of a Caspar David Friedrich, the great German romantic painter. And this idea, you know, the big trees out there, the space, then we're closed off, we're in here looking out. And this very real but not quite real light, that sort of light when the world sits still and reality disappears and something else opens up. It's that moment. Painters of light, maybe the great painters of light in the British tradition is what people like Patrick Caulfield, the great poet of the everyday, mainly through the use of light, through the use of colour. All works in a different way, but so although they're very sort of photographic, they're very much not. And the painstaking painting of these makes the image a bit like Christiana Baumgartner's The actual making of it is taking a long time. The image then becomes somehow more timeless, removed from the moment. And that's what the painting is, I guess. And the prints do the same thing in a way that's very worked and slightly hard one. Yeah. And the prints are made in two layers, which really kind of echoes this notion of a veil. And there's a reference in one of Paul's books where someone came to his studio and presumed that his paintings would be painted the same way, but in fact he works meticulously from top to bottom from a photograph. So it will be, it's not as if he's kind of repeating a few layers or kind of building up something, it will be completely finished in that corner and then kind of worked down kind of like that. It's an incredible kind of process to witness. And all he has a trolley where each paint colour is kind of ready and kind of lined out. So it's really kind of a fascinating process, this transition from this image to create this other kind of view which we enter as well.
And he talks about that looping as being a movement. Again, all the work in the show is just a lot of looping, going on, looking, searching, finding things, whatever they may look. But there's a kind of hard stare going on in some of these.
When I saw this work and was talking to Paul about it, there was a really strong resonance with Graham's painting, the one next to the garage, the apartment block, which is called House. And for me, it really summed up this idea of looking. So we have this this window, this threshold that we look out from in Paul's painting, but then in Graham's we have this other window that we're looking into, and it was this really kind of summarised this reciprocal gaze that we have in terms of looking into each other's world, and going back to that kind of quote that I mentioned this morning, and this realisation that those kind of ideas that we have about a place are quite parallel to other people's as well.
Not necessarily. I've got a show coming up in Dublin in a few weeks. So I'm trying to work out what goes into that. I'm doing a square in Bordeaux, a park with some children playing. What else am I doing? A hotel in Venice. I should mention that. Talky by night, which has got some hotels on the top of the hill. It's a sort of series, it's going to be a bit, I can't quite see it yet, but in my head the show is called Parks, Hotels and Palaces, after the old Kraftwerk lyric from their song Europe Endless. But I'm not sure if the images will fit. So there'll be a bit more multifarious, so there'll be, again, it'll be the whole show will create some sort of place made for all these other places, but there'll be more maybe public spaces, etc., rather than maybe single buildings. But we'll work out a lot of an idea. Thank you.